From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson. Ira Melman is off today, so no telling what's going to happen. On today's program, President Obama prepares to visit India with many issues on the agenda. A North Korean defector says some of his story is not true. We'll find out more on today's Daybreak Asia. Ray Kugel tells us how the story of the Mesot garbage dump came to the big screen in our weekly look at the movies. How has the Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris changed the dialogue on free speech in China? Sarah Williams considers the impact on China focus. Kids are teaching seniors in today's American Cafe. David Byrd tells us now that much of the world can afford to see more clearly. We'll also hear the top five songs of the week, business and sports as well. It's all coming your way today on VOA Global. Hi, and welcome to Daybreak Asia, our summary of Asian news and events for Friday, January 23rd. I'm Jim Stevenson. In brief today, President Obama embarks on a three-day visit to India. That begins Sunday, and it will be his second official visit to the country in what the White House on Wednesday called the latest sign that increasing U.S. engagement with New Delhi is a top foreign policy priority. Mr. Obama will become the first U.S. president to be the chief guest at India's Republic Day ceremonies on Monday, January 26th. That commemorates when the Indian Constitution went into effect in 1950. Climate change, boosting trade and investment, security cooperation, Afghanistan, and Iran are expected to be among the issues to be discussed between Mr. Obama and Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who visited Washington in September. Both leaders will also speak to U.S. and Indian businessmen about broadening the trade relationship currently running at about $100 billion annually. Mr. Obama will also address the Indian people Tuesday and even take part in Mr. Modi's monthly radio phone-in program. National University of Singapore Indian analyst Kanti Prasad Bajpai told VOA's Victor Beatty he believes he knows why.
I mean, I think Obama works well with Indian leaders. He often displayed his affection for Manmohan Singh as well. But I think what he likes in Modi is the fact that he's decisive, that he has a good majority in parliament, so he can be effective. And I think he likes his verbal quickness and the fact that he's a performer in public.
Prime Minister Modi has extended to President Obama the singular title of chief guest of the Republic Day festivities in India on Monday.
In India, foreign guests by inviting them to preside over the Republic Day parade. Of course, no U.S. president has been given that honor or has been able to come. So I think it really is a measure of how much Modi wants to reach out to the United States and wants to send a geopolitical message as well.
What are the driving issues in this relationship?
China looms very large for both countries. And, of course, China is India's immediate neighbor. So I think that's the clear first-order geopolitical issue. A second, of course, is the rise of militant Islam and the rise of IS and the U.S.'s move away from Afghanistan gradually in terms of its military presence. That means that, you know, the Indians are quite worried as well about militant Islam coming very close to their borders. Beyond that, issues such as energy security in the light of climate change, I think, are going to be very big. India and the United States are looking for a climate change deal. They're far apart on a global deal at the moment. And then, of course, I think on the American side, there's a very clear interest in opening up India's economy further so that American investors and businesses can do business in India much more easily. So I think these are some of the key drivers of the relationship at this point.
Bajpai says the two countries are already engaged in intelligence sharing in their joint effort to combat terrorism. He also says India has begun to open its market wider to foreign investment in the insurance and defense industries, but acknowledges more needs to be done, especially in longer-term investment. In an effort to reverse the skewed sex ratio in India because of illegal abortion of female fetuses, India's prime minister has launched a nationwide campaign to save and educate girls.
Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi that the falling number of girls to boys presents a major social challenge for the country.
In a hard-hitting message to the country, Prime Minister Narendra Modi said, "We cannot be counted as citizens of the 21st century." He said the practice of aborting female fetuses is worse than an 18th century mindset because girls are being killed even before they are born. Saying that placing sons above daughters is a psychological illness of the entire country, he called for a social awakening to treat girls on par with boys.
Jis behan ke pet mein bachchi hoti hai, wo katai nahi chahti hai.
The Prime Minister said no mother wants to get rid of her child, but family and social pressures make her complicit in this crime. In India's traditional culture, sons are looked upon as assets, breadwinners and caretakers of their parents in their old age. Girls are regarded as a liability because parents have to give a dowry when she marries. Studies show that since ultrasounds made sex determination possible, as many as 12 million girls may have been aborted during the past four decades in India. Mr. Modi launched the campaign to save the daughter, teach the daughter in Panipat in the northern Haryana state, a prosperous region that has the lowest number of girls to boys in the country, 879 for 1,000 males. The national average is 917 girls for 1,000 males. The program aims at improving the child sex ratio and gender equality through education. The new campaign will focus on 100 districts where the gender ratio is critical. A UN study last year warned the dwindling number of girls in the country has reached emergency proportions and is fueling an increase in crimes such as kidnapping and trafficking of women. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
The disclosure by a key United Nations witness that parts of his testimony about his life in North Korean prison camps were untrue is raising questions about the credibility of the UN report on human rights abuses in that country. VOA's Brian Padden reports while the United Nations says the altered testimony was not critical to the inquiry, his shifting story illustrates the difficulty of verifying information in one of the world's most secretive countries.
Shin Dong-hyuk's testimony in front of the UN Commission of Inquiry into North Korea helped document a network of political prisons in North Korea and atrocities that include murder, enslavement, and torture. But his recent admission that parts of his story are not true has prompted Pyongyang to cast doubts on the commission's report. North Korea's state-run news agency said the admission of his lies goes to prove that everything told by those who claim to be defectors from the North cannot be trusted. The UN Commission chairman has said the inaccuracy in Shin's testimony do not damage the credibility of the report that includes testimony from hundreds of witnesses. Shin Dong-hyuk maintains that the relevant details of his brutal torture in the camps are true, including being hung by a hook over fire and witnessing the execution of his mother and brother. But he admits he was misleading about certain dates and locations. He also failed to mention that he had escaped twice to China, where he was caught and sent back to North Korea, and that he was tortured for escaping at the age of 20, not 13, as he said in the past. Brian Padden, VOA News, Seoul.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. Be sure to stop by voanews.com. There you'll find longer versions of these stories, many of which have great photos and video. Our podcast is there, too. Subscribe to Daybreak Asia, and you'll never miss an episode.
Every day at this time on VOA Global, we'd like to hear from you, the audience, and there are many ways that you can tell us what's on your mind. You can write to us at voaasia at voanews.com. You can leave your comments on our webpage, voanews.com. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Weibo. One of the stories you just heard about was India's campaign to save and educate girls. It's on our website. Raman from New Jersey writes in response, if India has a social security system like the USA, then a boy or girl will not matter to parents. As long as the idea as son as a retirement solution survives, people will continue to prefer boys. Another of our stories, Pakistan says it wants an early repatriation of Afghan refugees in the country, but does not intend to forcefully evict them. Meanwhile, Afghan officials are warning that unwarranted pressure on the refugee population as part of Islamabad's increased counterterrorism measures could hinder bilateral ties. Syed from Pakistan writes, "We've had them for 35 years. It's more than enough time, and we're simply tired. They should be moved out to camps on the border with Afghanistan if they fail to go back. Most Afghans are uneducated, crime-ridden, unhygienic, bring disease, guns, and drugs into our society," and he says that we're not responsible for them. Their own country is. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe says his country is in a race against time to free two hostages being held by the Islamic State group for a $200 million ransom. Herman from Canada has his opinion. He says the Japanese government should not yield to the demand by ISIS. Whatever will be, so long as the Japanese stays firm together. Note, he says, this hostage situation is nothing new to the Japanese government. It has happened in the past with different terrorist groups. Let us know what you think on our website, voanews.com. This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. We're glad to have you with us. Coming up, free speech in China. It's long been debated just how much Chinese citizens can say in their society, whether it's actually in person or online. The latest terrorist attacks in Paris against the Charlie Hebdo newspaper has raised new questions about free speech in China. We'll hear more about it as Sarah Williams joins us with China Focus after Ray Kugel.
I'm Ray Kugel with CinemAsia, a movie look at Asian people, places, and things, both real and imagined. Mae Sot is a city in western Thailand that is part of a district sharing a border with Burma, also known as Myanmar. Just a 15-minute drive from its center is a garbage dump that is also home to 300 refugees from Myanmar. A documentary called Illegal Immigrants on the Mae Sot Garbage Dump shows how 100 families who have fled conflict at home have found refuge there and managed to survive in appalling conditions. Men, women, and children dig through mountains of trash to earn money by collecting plastic and glass bottles for recycling. They must rely on the kindness of volunteers who supply them with food and medical needs. Despite the hardships, the illegal squatters are shown to entertain themselves by ingeniously rigging up a makeshift movie theater using an electric generator, a television screen, and giant speakers. It is used to play DVDs, particularly for the children on weekends. But hovering ominously over all of those living at the Mae Sot dump is the fear of arrest and being sent back to Myanmar. Thai police periodically raid and demolish their tents and what few possessions they have. Many flee back to an uncertain future in Myanmar. Some residents stay behind, hoping to be left alone. Peter Henk Van Wyk directed Illegal Immigrants on the Mae Sot Garbage Dump. I spoke with Van Wyk about the humanitarian crisis he witnessed and what led to his getting involved.
It was an assignment for my previous graduation project from school, and I was wondering about the country Burma because at the time it was not really known. And then I read about it, that it had a lot of child soldiers and a lot of problems. And then I got more interested, and then I decided to go over there to the border on Thailand to get to know more about the conflict.
What kind of access did you have to film at the garbage dump?
I went there with Fred Stockwell. He was volunteering there for a few months. And first I just went with him to bring over some food and medicine. And after that, when we got to know each other more, I took out sometimes my camera. And they didn't mind me filming over there.
What kind of health problems are the people exposed to there?
It's not a very clean environment. When we brought a doctor over, the kids sometimes had nutrition problems a little bit, like they were a little bit sick. Once I brought a woman to the Meitao clinic because she was pregnant.
How do the immigrants there find anything to eat?
They work for money because they recycle plastic in the glass on the dump, and they work in shifts, and they bring it to the recycle center, and they get money.
Van Wyck's documentary puts the spotlight on an inhumane situation that's not gone away. This film is a call to action for yet another part of the world's impoverished, so often through no fault of their own. For more movie information, follow me at voanews.com. I'm Ray Kugel.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. The attacks on the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo have inspired mass demonstrations in support of free speech around the world. In communist China, where the officially atheist government imposes heavy restrictions on speech, the demonstrations have led to a different reaction. Shannon Van Sant reports from Beijing.
Charlie Hebdo has now printed more than 7 million copies of its first edition since gunmen killed 8 members of the editorial staff. But among some Muslims, there is renewed outrage over the magazine's cover that again features a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad, which some consider to be blasphemous. This simmering divide over free speech has also reached China, where the government keeps tight control over all publications and the internet. For Chinese authorities, the Paris attacks proved the dangers of an unrestrained press. The Xinhua News Agency published an editorial concluding there should be limits to free speech. Quote, "If people would put limits on themselves when venting freedom and respect others," Xinhua continued, "there would be fewer tragedies in the world." While it is expected that China's state-controlled media would not champion the inherent value of free speech, William Ni, a China researcher at Amnesty International, says the response also echoes Beijing's views on national sovereignty.
As they put it, the world is diversified and every religion and culture has its own core values. So I think that what they want to do is solidify this idea that different countries and different civilizations have their own core values that other countries need to respect.
China has long rejected foreign criticism of its tight restrictions of political freedoms, saying that other countries have no business dictating how it governs its citizens. An editorial titled "Free Speech Mania May Intensify Clashes in the State-Backed Global Times Newspaper" similarly criticized the West for its commitment to free speech. The editorial warned of more violence and conflict in Europe, fueled by unrestrained freedoms of speech in the press. Xiaohe Chang, a professor of international relations at Renmin University, says Chinese views on freedom of speech are heavily influenced by the Chinese political and educational systems that do not emphasize the history of civil society in other countries. Chang says that is why reaction to the Paris attacks is so different in China from the rest of the world.
Chinese people also need to understand the political cultures in Paris that peoples in that countries enjoy a high degree of freedom, including the freedom of expressions. And I think it's Chinese peoples, a number of the Chinese peoples have no ideas. The specific as political cultures in France. France is the place that revolutions took place and the people in which people championed the freedom, human rights. And I think that's the Chinese people should really need to understand.
Gauging reaction among Chinese citizens is difficult given government censorship, but some commentators online express support for free speech in the wake of attacks. Others question why they cannot march in solidarity, like the millions of people in Paris last week, since Beijing banned such gatherings. China has also experienced terrorist attacks in recent years by groups that authorities say are Islamic extremists fighting against the state. Last year, a gang of masked men and women that the government called Muslim terrorists stabbed 30 people to death at a train station in Yunnan province in an attack that many called China's 9/11. Rachel Liu, a writer who studies China's social media, says some online commentators have gradually turned against the outpouring of sympathy following the Paris attacks, asking why China's terrorist incidents have not provoked a similar response.
But at the same time, you know, China has also suffered terror attacks. And why didn't the U.S. and Europe have the same kind of outpour of sympathy for the Chinese victims? And is there a double standard? I think that is gradually as the story evolved and, you know, more and more outpouring from the West began to surface in the news, and this is what the Chinese reaction began also to evolve along those lines.
Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
This is Asia Business News on VOA Global. I'm Jim Stevenson. Macau, the Chinese territory known for casino gambling, has outperformed the rest of the world's major cities, at least economically last year, according to a new report out Thursday. Cities in the developing world, especially China, dominated the top of the annual economic rankings of 300 cities worldwide by the Brookings Institution and J.P. Morgan Chase. One exception was Bangkok, Thailand, which came in last, its economy wrecked by political strife. Macau, meanwhile, has enjoyed a tourism boom, with gamblers coming to bet at more than 30 casinos, including the Vietnam Macau, which is currently the world's largest. LG says it will begin selling a new curved smartphone next week in its latest effort to bring the curve to a mass market. The South Korean company said Thursday that the G Flex 2 will be launched locally January 30th and then overseas in the coming months. Curved screens are a way of differentiating high smartphones that have come to share many similar features, such as high-resolution displays and powerful cameras. When LG released its first version of a curved smartphone in 2013, it was just a niche product. The latest iteration shows LG is targeting a much larger audience. The 10-country Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, will be able to declare itself an economic community by the end of the year, even though some thorny issues, mostly about services, are not likely to be resolved. Trade and Industry Minister from Malaysia conceded that countries which include Cambodia, Singapore, and Vietnam will not agree to every proposal to make the region a more integrated one economically. However, in an interview with the Associated Press, he expects the current 85% or so agreement to rise to 95% by the end of the year. That's Asia Business News on VOA Global.
This is Today in History. On January 23, 1556, the deadliest known earthquake in history struck in the Shaanxi province of central China, killing more than 800,000 people. On this day in 1789, Georgetown University, located in Washington, D.C., was founded. It's the oldest Jesuit and Roman Catholic university in the United States. In 1960, the U.S. Navy's self-propelled deep-sea diving bathyscape, the Swiss-designed and Italian-built Trieste, reached a record depth of nearly 11,000 meters off the Pacific island of Guam. In 1968, the USS Pueblo, a Navy intelligence vessel, was seized by North Korea. The U.S. said the vessel was in international waters. The 83-man crew was incarcerated and mistreated for 11 months until its negotiated release. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
An international group of 52 skydivers were recorded creating a record-setting head-up formation over Arizona. The video was shot by one of the participants, Zachary Sable, on a helmet camera, and it shows the skydivers joining hands in a pre-planned formation while in the head-up position, which mimics standing. Head-up body flight is the most difficult position to balance while being able to build formations, Sable wrote after he
ended up on the ground. In head-up flying, we're balancing mass over lift, so you're battling aerodynamics the entire time. The stunt was organized by Skydive Arizona of Phoenix, carried out November 22nd of last year. Members of the same group set the previous record just a day earlier with 44 skydivers participating in the stunt. Well, just a head up, the latest world news is coming your way next with Michael Lippin and International Edition. We hope you stay tuned.
It's time for International Edition on the Voice of America. Coming up, could it be the end for Yemen's president? One of his officials says he's resigned under pressure from Houthi rebels. A former senior U.S. official makes a dramatic warning about Russia's perceived territorial ambitions. And we'll have the latest from the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the death toll from political violence is growing. I'm Michael Lippin. Yemen's President Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi and his cabinet have tendered their resignations. It's the latest development in a power struggle between the Yemeni president and the Houthi militia who seized control of his office and residence earlier this week. The Yemeni government spokesman in Washington announced the resignation of the embattled president via social media on Thursday. The Reuters news agency quoted him as saying the government does not want to be involved in what he called an unconstructive political maze. Speaking from Sana'a, UN envoy Jamal Ben-Ammar said the political crisis would only be resolved if the parties honor earlier agreements that call for power sharing and an end to violence. Well, the crisis has left many Yemenis uncertain about where the country is heading politically. Heather Murdoch has more on that from London.
Analysts say most likely the Houthis initially stopped short of taking over the government because the rebel group could possibly wield more power from behind the scenes. But as he walks the streets of the Yemeni capital Thursday, 29-year-old human rights activist Fraz Shamsen speaks on his mobile phone, saying the only thing locals really know is that they do not know exactly what is going on.
They're controlling everything, even the president's house.
And senior Yemeni journalist Zaid Alaleya says the public has little faith in political agreements.
You see in the agreement something written papers, but in reality it's broken immediately, sometimes in the same day of signing it.
The Houthis have been fighting the Yemeni government to retain their northern strongholds since the mid-2000s. In September, Houthi fighters swept into the capital, and they continue to battle for control of other parts of Yemen. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, London.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says Iraqi ground forces backed by international coalition airstrikes have made significant gains in the fight against Islamic State militants. Speaking Thursday at an international meeting in London, Kerry said Iraqi troops have retaken 700 square kilometers of territory in the country. The meeting of 21 members of the International Coalition Against the Islamic State was aimed at assessing coalition achievements and planning the next steps of the campaign. In recent days, Iraqi Kurdish fighters allied to the coalition have pushed back Islamic State militants in parts of northern Iraq and cut off a key supply route to the militant-occupied city of Mosul. The White House says U.S. President Barack Obama will not meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when Mr. Netanyahu visits Washington in early March to speak to a joint meeting of Congress. A national security spokeswoman said Thursday that as a matter of longstanding practice, the president does not meet with heads of state in close proximity to their elections. Mr. Netanyahu is set to be in the U.S. Capitol on March 3rd, 2 weeks ahead of an Israeli election in which he's seeking a fourth term in office. The White House statement was in response to Wednesday's unexpected announcement by a political opponent of Mr. Obama, Speaker John Boehner. Boehner said he invited the Israeli Prime Minister to address Congress to talk about what the House Speaker called grave threats that radical Islam and Iran pose to the United States. Well, a former top U.S. official says the United States and its allies should deploy troops to the Baltic states to deter possible Russian aggression there. Speaking Wednesday before the Senate Armed Services Committee, former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski said he feared that Russian President Vladimir Putin might try to invade the Baltic capitals of Latvia and Estonia in a lightning move that could take the West by surprise.
One day, he just seizes Riga and Tallinn. It would literally take him one day. There's no way they could resist. And then we'll say how horrible, how shocking, how outrageous. But, of course, we can't do anything about it.
where Brzezinski said pre-positioning a limited number of U.S. and allied forces in the Baltic states would send a strong signal to Russia and provide a deterrent without being provocative. At least 13 people were killed on Thursday in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk when a trolley bus was hit in an apparent mortar attack, sparking accusations of blame from both Ukraine and Russia. Ukraine's Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk published a statement on the government's website blaming what he called Russian terrorists for the attack in the city that has been at the center of the months-long conflict between Ukrainian government troops and pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Ukrainian forces were responsible for what he called a monstrous crime and a crude provocation. The Democratic Republic of Congo's Senate has announced a one-day delay for its vote on a proposed electoral law that has sparked days of violent protests. DRC senators now say they will vote Friday on the bill, which would require the completion of a national census before a presidential election can be held. Opponents of the bill say that if passed, it would allow Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila to stay in office beyond the end of his term in 2016. The International Federation for Human Rights says 42 people have been killed in protests against the bill since Monday, mostly in the capital, Kinshasa. But a government spokesman disputes that account, saying Thursday that only 12 people have been killed, including a policeman. VOA's Gabe Joslow has more.
Human Rights Watch Congo researcher Ida Sawyer, speaking to VOA from Kinshasa, put the number killed somewhat lower, confirming 20 deaths since Monday.
In many cases, police and Republican Guard soldiers, who are part of the president's security detail, fired directly into crowds of protesters. In some cases, the protesters were also violent and hurled rocks at the police and Republican Guard soldiers. At least two policemen have died in the protest.
Opposition groups say the proposed law, which calls for a census before the next presidential election due in 2016, is a ploy to allow President Kabila to stay in power beyond the two terms mandated in the Constitution. A census would likely take 2 to 3 years in the vast underdeveloped country, which has few paved roads and many active rebel groups, especially in the northeastern provinces. Protesters so far have involved student groups, opposition activists, and civil society organizations. The influential Catholic Church has also opposed any move to delay elections. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
Indonesian divers have recovered 6 more bodies from the seafloor near the fuselage of AirAsia Flight 8501 as underwater currents eased long enough for them to explore the area. The bodies were found strapped in their seats during the search on Thursday. Strong currents have prevented Indonesian divers from entering the aircraft's main section, which is sitting at the bottom of the Java Sea, about 30 meters below the surface. Well, that's it for International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Michael Lippin. Thanks for listening.
This is Business News on VOA Global. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson. The European Central Bank on Thursday launched its most aggressive effort to date to revive the region's ailing economy, a program to buy 1.1 trillion euros in government and private bonds that will begin in March. The long-awaited program was an emphatic statement of the central bank's willingness to do all it can to rejuvenate the economy shared by the 19-nation Euro Currency Alliance. And it showed the multinational ECB's readiness to assert its independence against critics in Germany, the Eurozone's largest and most politically influential country. United Airlines' fourth quarter profit fell 80% because of severance costs and contracts that were lost, and lost value, that is, as oil prices tumbled. And without those one-time setbacks, the airline's adjusted profits soared. The split shows that how falling oil prices are a boon and a burden to the airlines. A price of fuel, their biggest expense, is lower, but so is the value of contracts that most airlines hold to hedge against rising energy costs. Those paper losses generated by fuel hedging contracts are obscuring how well airlines are actually doing. Solid travel demand is translating into higher fares and more money from add-on fees for checked bags and also other services. Some of McDonald's workers who say they were fired because of their race are now suing the fast food giant, accusing it of dodging responsibility for discrimination and harassment that they say they endured. The workers said in a federal complaint filed Thursday that about 15 African-American employees of some Southern Virginia restaurants were fired last May after several white employees were hired. Many of those fired were told that they were good workers but did not fit the profile that the owners were trying to build for the company. That's a look at business news on VOA Global. Well, if you happen to wear glasses or contact lenses, you probably know that those things are pretty expensive, and especially if you have to continue to get glasses and contacts because your eyes are changing, you know, that's a lot out of your pocket. Well, there's a new way now to get some glasses in the hands of people who really need them at an affordable price. We'll hear more about that right after the American Cafe.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. In a typical classroom setting, older people are teaching younger ones. But when it comes to learning about high-tech devices and internet navigation, the situation can easily be reversed. That is what's happening in Columbia, Maryland, where a free workshop offers seniors technology lessons taught by teenagers, even younger instructors who've grown up in the digital age. Faiza Al-Masri reports on what happens when seniors catch up with the younger generation in technology. Faith Lapidus narrates.
When Myra Stafford signed up for this workshop, she had one goal in mind. The 73-year-old wanted to learn how to use her iPad.
My daughter gave it to me, and she's been long waiting for me to use it.
Her daughter won't have to wait too long because Stafford is learning fast.
I am more confident today than I was before. Today I have more hands-on. Working with young people makes it wonderful because that's all they know. And they didn't make me feel that I was old or dumb.
11-year-old Zion Perkins is Stafford's teacher.
You have to be really, really patient, you know, because some of them might not know as well as others, so you have to be really patient.
Center Director Merity McCaig added the senior tech workshop last year after receiving a donation of several iPads from a local community organization. About 100 seniors have signed up for the classes since then.
As people are aging, their worlds get a little smaller. Some of them can no longer drive. Some of them don't get out to make long trips to see their relatives. And it brings them back out into Facebook and to Skype. And just to be able to communicate, they can do everything from ordering things from Amazon now to ordering groceries or meals.
Teaching seniors about technology also benefits the economy, says career and retirement expert Carrie Hannon.
You have a huge growing population over 60 that's just expanding and offers an incredible opportunity to buy online, to research products that they want to buy, maybe not online, but they research them online. So about a third of internet users in general are over 50. As seniors get more excited about using the technology, they're going into the marketplace and buying it. So that's a boom for the economy right there.
As people live longer, retirees may consider getting back into the workforce. And the internet, Hannon says, is a valuable resource that helps them do that.
It is absolutely critical if you're looking for a job in today's market and you're over the age of 50, you absolutely have to be up to speed to technology. There are no excuses. A paper resume is no longer the big thing today. You need to have an online resume. You need to have your LinkedIn presence. And that's how you're going to network. That's how you're going to find jobs today.
That's Carlton Reed Calloway's goal.
When I was retiring in 1995, the computer world was coming in, and I was going out. So I didn't think that it was necessary for me to learn how to use a computer. You know, I was ready just to leave, to get out of it.
Now, as he starts his second career as an actor, it's a necessity.
You have to go online for job interviews. You have to go online to fill out applications. And everything is done online now. And if you don't know how to go online to do these things, I mean, so I had to get in touch with the new world.
17-year-old workshop instructor Madison Lamb showed him how. She's getting something from the class, too.
I think I've learned a lot and how to connect with people and work with, because I'm usually a shy person, so I'm not really good at, like, connecting with others besides my family and friends. So I've learned to be more outgoing.
The benefits for the young teachers go beyond building social skills, says Sapphire Windley with the Youth and Teen Center, which runs the program.
I find in this day and age, our young people, they're trying to explore and find out how do they add value to life, just trying to find their way. So this is something where they're needed and their skill set is valued and it gives them purpose.
For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Join us every day on air, online, and podcast at voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. If you're like me, you need glasses or contact lenses to see properly. But in the developing world, a pair of glasses can cost more than a year's wages, and many people just do without. But a British entrepreneur has come up with a way that people can get the glasses they need for less than $2. James Chen grew up in Africa and has worn glasses since he was a teenager. As an adult, he founded Vision for a Nation, a program which will provide glasses to people in Rwanda. With help from subsidies, Vision for a Nation can provide specs for about $1.50. Chen told the Associated Press that the charity aims to get the glasses to the people who need them.
Particularly in the developing world, you know, you don't have the access to a store like this one, you know, in the UK. It's not around the corner. So they don't have the opportunity to have their eyes corrected.
These glasses use a special adjustable lens, so people will be able to correct their vision simply by turning a knob on the end of the glasses' frames. Chen says that the process makes having good vision simple.
You have two lenses as they move against each other in the part of the eye that you can see out. You know, the power changes with the two lenses moving against each other. The other technology we have is the fluid-filled, which is a chamber. On one side, you have a plastic sheet, and as you put in the fluid, which is a silicone oil, it changes the curvature of that, and so that's what's changing the power.
Vision for a Nation chose Rwanda to test its plan because the country has a healthcare system that is accessible. The British Medical Journal found that there are now hundreds of doctors in that country and thousands of nurses and other healthcare workers. That made getting glasses to those who need it in Rwanda easier than in other areas. Chen's company, Alden's, makes the adjustable lenses. Graham McKenzie is one of Alden's ophthalmologists.
Each lens comprises two pieces of plastic, and each of those pieces of plastic has a wave-like shape to it. So some parts of the lens are thinner, some parts are thicker. And when you move them across one another, what you're doing is you're varying the thickness of the lens, and that is what changes the power of the lens.
McKenzie says making the lenses in the proper thickness to correct a variety of eye problems was a big challenge. But current technology has enabled Alden's to produce lenses that can handle almost any vision problem.
If you're talking about people who have variable eyesight, this is a product that you can continually change the power on. So if your eyesight does fluctuate from day to day or even minute to minute, you can just readjust the lens power to meet your needs. The technology as it currently stands has a very high power range. So high, in fact, that we can capture 90% of all the sorts of refractive errors that are out in the world.
Graham McKenzie told the Associated Press that the adjustable glasses are so good, they can even be used for things like driving.
We've done a lot of scientific research, sponsored by, for example, the World Bank. We've also been working with the University of Michigan to investigate whether these glasses could be used safely for things like driving. And what we found is that they perform as well as prescription glasses when driving.
James Chen told the AP that he took a trip to Rwanda recently and was encouraged by the progress he saw there.
The best was one of the nurses, one who was not trained by us. You know, he came up to me and said, you know, I didn't realize, but I needed glasses. And now that I have them, I can do a much better job serving the people who are coming to this health center. And so, you know, it's these kind of stories that really make what I've been trying to do really meaningful and very tangible.
Depending on how well the project goes in Rwanda, Chen says that Vision for a Nation could expand its program to other countries. So what do you think? Let us know your opinion by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can always email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
Well, most people are looking for a competitive edge. A Super Nintendo player says he found one by playing Super Mario World. He exploited a glitch and then uploaded his results to YouTube. He says that he was able to play the game in a world record time of 5 minutes 59 seconds, and then he posted a second video dropping that time even further. Well, the world record for finishing Super Mario World without the glitch is currently about 9 minutes 48 seconds. This is Sports on VOA Global. I'm Jim Stevenson, looking for a competitive edge. The New England Patriots, as they head to the Super Bowl, quarterback Tom Brady addressed the swirling controversy involving his team and their use of game balls that were apparently underinflated. The National Football League says it found 11 of the Patriots' 12 game balls from their AFC Championship game win over the Indianapolis Colts were inflated significantly below the NFL's requirements. Well, Brady said in a closed-door meeting with his team, he likes footballs a certain way, but his team should stay focused on the Super Bowl. In a press conference, Brady admitted that there is a process he goes through in getting used to using game day footballs. He says it's like any other piece of equipment for him, but he repeatedly professed his innocence in doctoring any of those footballs. Head coach Bill Belichick said that he was also stunned by the news of the illegal footballs. In golf, there's a three-way tie heading into the third round of the Commercial Bank Cotter Masters Tournament in Doha. Nick Dai is there, and he reports two South Africans, Brendan Grace and George Coetzee, share the 9-under-par lead alongside Bernd Weisberger of Austria.
Grace has been in some terrific form, capturing the title at Leopard Creek prior to Christmas, enjoying some good days at the two subsequent events. He's looking nearly as consistent as the year he had 4 European Tour victories. It'd be no surprise should he claim another success this week.
Yeah, it was good. I got off to the start that I wanted to. I got it, I think it was 3 under through 9, which was nice. And, fell a little bit of sleep on the back nine. But, it was nice. So it's, it's a good way to be at the middle half stage of the tournament. So I'll take it, going tight in the lead with 2 rounds to go.
Coetzee showed promise in Abu Dhabi and tends to do well in Qatar, so again, it was expected he'd be in the running, while Weisberger finished 6th last weekend. He's maintaining a high standard with a round of 66. The trio are one clear of the field. Defending champion Sergio Garcia is nicely in the hunt at 6 under par.
Nick Dye reporting. Los Angeles Lakers guard Kobe Bryant suffered a torn rotator cuff in his right shoulder in the second half of Wednesday night's loss to the New Orleans Pelicans. He had an MRI. They don't know the results yet, and it's not clear what that injury means for Bryant's status going forward. That's sports on VOA Global.
Hi, I'm Ray McDonald on The Voice of America, and this is the Top 5 Countdown. We're celebrating the 5 most popular songs in the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart for the week ending January 24th, 2015. Some weeks bring chart lineups that make you shake your head with amazement. And then there's this week. Very little changes, except in 5th place, where Sam Smith makes a return trip with I'm Not the Only One. The Brit Award nominations were announced Thursday, and Sam leads the field. Stay tuned for more. Smith rebounds 3 slots to number 5 with I'm Not the Only One. Sam had better make room in his trophy case. Not only is he up for 6 Grammy Awards, he's also just been nominated for 5 Brit Awards. The Grammys happen on February 8th, with the Brits following on the 25th. Sam's fellow UK artist Ed Sheeran earned a few Brit nominations of his own. I'll have details after Thinking Out Loud, holding at number 4.
So honey, now take me into your loving arms. Kiss me under the light of a thousand stars. Place your head on my beating heart. I'm thinking now.
Sheeran holds in 4th place with Thinking Out Loud. That's the highest he's ever gone on the Hot 100. Ed just collected 4 Brit Award nominations: British Male Solo Artist, British Single for Thinking Out Loud, MasterCard British Album of the Year, and British Artist Video of the Year. All right, one more Brit item, and then we'll move on, I promise you. Hozier just earned a nomination, and you'll hear all about it after Take Me to Church.
Take me to church,
spends another week in 3rd place with Take Me to Church. The Irish singer-songwriter just earned a Brit Award nomination for Best International Male Solo Artist. He faces off against Beck, Jack White, John Legend, and Pharrell Williams. Oh, look at that. Taylor Swift just earned a Brit nomination, too. Yes, we'll cover it after Blank Space, holding in 2nd place.
And I'll write your name.
Taylor Swift remains your runner-up with Blank Space. If you haven't guessed it yet, Taylor's Brit nomination is in the Best International Female Solo Artist category. She's up against Beyoncé, Lana Del Rey, Sia, and St. Vincent. Taylor previously received 2 Brit nominations but has never won. Oh, what the heck. Our top singles act is also in the running for some Brit awards. I'll have more after Uptown Funk, from Mark Ronson and Bruno Mars.
Girl said you hallelujah. Girl said you hallelujah. Girl said you hallelujah. Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you. Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you. Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you. Saturday night and we in the spot. Don't believe me, just watch.
Mark Ronson and Bruno Mars hold the Hot 100 title for a 2nd big week with Uptown Funk. It just earned 2 Brit Award nominations for British Single and British Artist Video of the Year. Once again, the Brit Awards get handed out on February 25th. So there you are. A very Brit-filled countdown has come to an end. I guess it was a special lineup after all. Join me for more action next week. I'm Ray McDonald, and this has been the Top 5 Countdown on The Voice of America.
Well, while we're busy counting down songs, residents of the Welsh capital Cardiff were busy casting their votes, not for music, but for the top restaurants in their area. They had a restaurant rating website, and they chose the city's top eatery. It ended up being a prison-based restaurant staffed by inmates. It's called the Clink Restaurant. It operates out of the HM Prison Cardiff. It's staffed by 30 prisoners, and it was chosen over 945 other eateries in Cardiff to earn the top rating on TripAdvisor. The restaurant offers breakfast and lunch service. It opened to the public back in 2012, and it features a staff of prisoners who are each paid about $21 per 40-hour work week. Officials said the prisoners obtain national catering qualifications that can help them land jobs at luxury hotels and Michelin-starred restaurants. That, of course, after they've done their time and they're released. Jason Lawrence is the general manager at the Clink Restaurant. He says the whole team is delighted to have made it to the top spot on TripAdvisor and to be ranked so highly against almost 1,000 restaurants in the city. He said that indeed is a huge achievement for them. If you happen to dine at the Clink restaurant and you come back and you see some familiar faces, well, that means some of the workers have returned. The prison says the rate of reoffending among former prisoners who worked at the Clink is 12.5%, but that actually is pretty good because the national average sits at 47%. Well, we're going to get out our napkins and wipe our face off and say goodbye for now. Thanks for listening to VOA Global. Daryl Smith was our engineer, Tracy Carter, our director and producer, and Diane Gower, managing editor. I'm Jim Stevenson. We hope you have a great weekend.